Alex, I believe I have reached the equivalent of nirvana.
Tell me more.
Well, I have been sleeping on my cozy earth sheets.
Wow.
And when I get up in the morning, I put on my fantastic jogger suit.
Yes.
Which is a funny way to put it, but you started saying that, so I'm just going to keep on going. And it is opening my mind to things I didn't know I could open my mind to.
Casey, all I have to say is, welcome to the other side.
It's incredible, Alex.
I've lived two lives. One of them is before Cozy Earth, and one is after.
Which is right now.
That's right. We're talking Cozy Earth. They make incredible, soft, lovely, temperature-controlled bedding and cozy wear.
Cozy Earth makes the best clothes I think I've ever touched, that have ever touched my skin.
Casey, I'm right there with you.
It's soft, it's breathable, it's temperature regulated, it looks good, it feels good, which makes it good.
And how about this for good? All of their products come with a 100-night sleep trial and a 10-year warranty. So if for some completely batshit reason you don't love these sheets, you can return them.
Now, Alex, right around the corner is Mother's Day. If you haven't already done something, which you should have,
yeah,
now's your moment. Go buy your mom some Cozy Earth, because it is the thing that will help her sleep at night. It's the thing that will help keep her comfortable at all moments of her life. And that's what you want for your mom.
So she isn't up all night thinking about what a disappointment her children are.
Exactly, because they didn't get her Cozy Earth. You don't want to be on that level.
Well, Casey, here's some exciting news. All Completely Arbitrary listeners get 35% off at CozyEarth.com with promo code TREES. Again, that's promo code TREES, T-R-E-E-S, for 35% off at Cozy Earth. So get yourself cozy. Get your mom cozy. Hell, get your dad cozy and your friends cozy.
Yeah, it doesn't have to stop there, you know?
Make the earth cozy with Cozy Earth.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
What's up, Fungal Associates? Welcome to Completely Arbitrary's Triazaki, the podcast about trees and other related topics, and the films of Studio Ghibli and Hayao Miyazaki. My name is Alex Croson.
Alex, I'm Casey Clapp.
Wow.
I just heard you say Ghibli.
Well, let's talk about it, please.
Let's. I'm so... Did you have to look into this? Is it pronounced Jinko or Ginkgo?
Jinko. Like the pants.
Yeah, is that a thing?
I think that's a type of pant.
Oh, wow.
But okay, so I was watching an interview in the ever-unfolding research that is happening for this project. Mm-hmm. I was watching an interview with Miyazaki-san.
Yeah.
Or is it Hayao-san? I think it's Miyazaki-san. I think it's last.
You're the one who did the research.
And it was in Japanese as he speaks.
Okay. This so far tracks.
And I heard him say Ghibli. So I think from the horse's mouth, I'm sorry, that's disrespectful, I believe it's Ghibli.
Interesting. We've been doing it wrong this whole time.
We have been.
Wow.
So I'm going to go back and edit. We need to get a clean version of you saying Ghibli and me saying Ghibli. I'm going to go back and edit every single time we say it.
Yeah, let's do it right now.
Okay, go for it.
Ghibli. Perfect. And now I'll do it as if I'm saying it. Ghibli.
Nice.
Ghibli. got a couple in there? So
yeah,
you can
use it? Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'll do mine. Ghibli. Ghibli. And then one more. Ghibli.
Wow. Yeah, I remember when you said that in the show where you were like, Ghibli. And I was like, yeah, okay.
Casey, today we are talking the Japanese fur.
That's right, we are.
And more broadly, we're talking about the film Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind.
Yeah. Hey, how do you pronounce the thing that cut off all the heads of the French nobles during the revolution?
I call that a guillotine.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Me too.
Do you say a guillotine?
I don't. No, I say gelatine.
A gelatine.
Yeah.
I say gelatin.
Oh, the gelatin. Well, I can just cut through that with my fork. Can I cut your head off? Pathetic.
They drowned all the nobles in vats of jello.
They couldn't eat it out. Anyway.
Yes, today we're talking Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind. I will say for this series, kind of a sleeper hit.
Oh, you think so?
I think so.
I haven't seen the next one that we're going to be watching, which is Princess Mononoke.
Right.
But, I will say between the first two, Spirited Away and My Neighbor Totoro, this is different. This one's quite a bit different.
I can't wait to talk about the differences. I can't wait to talk about everything about it. I will give a little bit of a tease. It's actually a pretty big tease. My favorite so far.
Which is amazing to me. I would not have guessed that.
I know.
I would not have guessed that.
Me either.
Yeah, I'll give you a quick tease as well. This is probably the quintessential example of the movies that when I was younger, I would see this on TV and I'd look at it and be like, oh, I want nothing to do with this. I don't know why, but like this and like Pokemon, I was just like against it. Like I was not hurt. I did not have any trauma. I was just like, everyone was like, I'm into Pokemon. And I'm like, oh yeah, well, Pokemon sucks. I'm not.
Well, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. And I think I probably felt the same way until a handful of years ago, Casey.
Yeah, wow. Well, we're all learning. I enjoyed it. Today as an adult, watching it with my, how should I say, learned eye.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there we go.
Your cultured framework.
Thank you, Alex. Yeah. Someone finally noticed.
And to talk about this film, because we have to talk about a tree every episode, we're talking about the Japanese fir.
That's right. Otherwise known as the Momi fir, which if you are in Japanese and also speak English, you would know that that means the fir.
Cute.
Yeah, because it's just that Momi is the Japanese term for fur, so as in F-I-R.
It's the fur.
Yeah, it's the fur.
Fur.
Mm-hmm.
Can I take a stab at the Latin name for this one?
Yeah, sure.
Is it Abies japonica?
No, it's all not. Right. It's a good guess, though. This is actually Abies firma.
Wow.
Yeah, and honestly, I don't know for sure, but I believe that it is in reference to having stiff needles. But I, during our intense break, will figure that out.
All right. I love little on-the-fly research, Casey.
Yeah, isn't it great? That's what I do.
Well, Casey, before we do that, we're here to remind you once again that we are moving away from Patreon.
That's right.
In favor of our brand new support platform, completely arbitrary, Treemium.
Treemium.
Yes, and that can be found at arbitrarypod.supercast.com.
That's right. You can also go to any place on the internet that has something to do with us, and there will be a link probably.
Yes, it is our new support platform. We have bonus episodes and bonus audio content. Mm-hmm. We've got live streams on there. We've got monthly cone stickers. We've got ad-free listening for the first time ever.
That's right.
Right in your podcast player of choice.
Yes, so you don't need to switch back and forth through different applications.
That's right.
All one spot.
And if you already subscribe to our Patreon, go to arbitrarypod.supercast.com/patreons. You've also been sent a link to the email that you use to sign up for Patreon, and there's a migration tool that you will use and be grandfathered into your Patreon price. We've really slimmed things down, Casey. We've consolidated. We've adjusted for inflation.
Yeah.
And we feel really good about it. I feel immensely less stressed than I do running a Patreon.
Yeah, that's good. It's helpful on all sides, I think.
Yeah.
So hopefully it's going to be great. So go sign up if you're interested. You can also gift subscriptions.
That's right.
At this time of year, people tend to give gifts a lot. Mm-hmm. So take advantage of this if you have that tree person in your life. And you're just thinking, man, I just want to give them a cone every single month for the next year or two.
You know, Casey, this is, I'm removing myself from the the co-host role here.
This is just Alex talking right to
yes.
you.
Yes. I think objectively, as a person who is interested in trees or nature, I would be so fucking stoked to get a gifted subscription to Completely Arbitrary Tree Man.
Yes. I would also like open up that package and then everyone's like, yeah, look, you're going to get sweet cones. I'd be like, yes. Yes. Thank you.
Hey, we know what to get Casey this year.
Yeah, please do. Send it my way.
And Casey, in addition to that, we have so much going on here.
Yes, we
Completely
do.
Arbitrary. We also have a December sale. Our very, very cleverly named holiday themed sale is going on right now at Completely arbitrarypod.com/merch.
That's right.
Get yourself a t-shirt. What you got to say?
I was just going to say we have 3 different t-shirts available and they're all amazing.
That's right. Get one of each. And Casey, all you got to do is use the coupon code, the discount code, TREES, mm-hmm. TREES, for 15% off the entire catalog of merch we have on our website. It's a great way to support the podcast and give something to the tree lover in your life.
Exactly. So go find that. Now.
And right now, we're also going to take a break. We will be right back with the Japanese fir and Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind here on Completely Arbitrary's Triazaki. Casey, you know our future's bright.
Yeah, it is, Alex.
But it's so bright, we gotta wear shades.
What?
Casey and I are now putting on our gooder glasses.
Oh, man. I can't see a damn thing.
Hey, they do the job, huh?
These things are great.
Casey, that's right. This episode is brought to you by Gooder.
It sure is right.
That is Goodr. They make fashionable sunnies.
They make fantastic sunglasses. Alex, I got a quick story. When they approached us, I said, I cannot tell you how excited I am about this. They saved me when I was riding my bike across Iowa in Ragbri last July.
Wow.
I couldn't see. I got hit in the eye. So one of my eyes from a week prior would not constrict. It was constantly dilated.
Oh my God.
So I had to wait till it like essentially refixed itself. I ended up needing to wear sunglasses on the entire drive and driving back over, but I had cheap gas station sunglasses.
Yeah.
It was $5 or something.
Yeah.
And they just did not do the job. I was absolutely in hell. And damn. Then stopped over at a shop that was there and then picked up a pair of sunglasses and it said it was $25. And I was like, what? These are okay. I'll try them out. I just need a new pair.
Yeah.
All polarized. I put them on my face and it was like the world had changed.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure I cried, Alex.
Casey,
like, I love these sunglasses.
I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. They saved me.
That's amazing, Casey. And they didn't save me yet.
Well, the time will come.
The day will come when I need these glasses and I have them. I do love these sunglasses, Casey. And I was telling you before we started recording, my problem with sunglasses mm-hmm. is that I always either buy, like you said, a cheap gas station pair for $6 or I could debase myself by spending $200 on a pair of sunglasses at Nordstrom or some shit. I ain't doing that. Casey, Gooder are the perfect middle ground.
They sure are. Starting at $25, they're all 100% polarized. You can look into water and see through it.
Oh my God.
Which is incredible.
Is that true?
It is. They're polarized.
Yeah. Oh, well, these would be great for fishing, eh?
Exactly.
And they would be great for cycling, working out, golfing, going to the beach, hiking, or just walking around town.
Just doing anything. I rode my bike across Iowa with these sunglasses. People wear them while they are jogging. They stay on your face. They don't bounce. They are excellently made. I cannot recommend Gooder enough.
And Casey, they're pretty cool. In fact, you and I got a couple pairs.
Oh, yeah. What did you get?
Mine are called Hellhound Hallucinations.
Ooh, Alex, I got The Future is Void.
Amazing.
Now, for those of you who are unfamiliar, that's the name of our sunglasses.
Yes.
Not our new catchphrases for Completely Arbitrary.
Hey, man, you know what I say. Hellhound Hallucinations.
Yeah, he does say that.
And if you want to support this show and try a pair of Gooder, they are giving Completely Arbitrary listeners free shipping. You can go to goodr.com/trees. That's GOODR.com/trees and use code trees for free shipping. Gooder offers a 30-day money-back guarantee and 100% satisfaction. Again, that's gooder.com/trees and use code trees for free shipping. We'll see you in the future.
Which is void.
And bright.
Yeah, you look good. You look good.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary's Triazaki. Today we are talking Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind.
That's right.
And we are talking the Japanese fur. How exciting.
It's very exciting. I have also other exciting news.
What is your other? Oh, a follow-up.
The scientific name is Abies firma, which means strong.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, just so you know, I successfully researched this.
Nice. The Chekhov's gun has been fired.
A little early. Yes, we did. It did come out a little early. So sorry, everyone. You can end here. This is all we got.
No. Casey, let's imagine that you and I are walking through a Japanese fir forest. How about that?
Oh, that sounds delightful.
And we come across some of these Japanese fir because they're absolutely all around us.
They are everywhere.
Let's ID this tree.
All right, Alex. Now, the first thing to note is that we are not walking through a fir forest. It actually happens that this species tends to grow with a lot of other friends. You're not going to very often find it as like a Douglas fir out here.
Yeah.
You see forests and forests of nothing but one species.
Yeah, what do you call dominantly? That? Monoculture?
Yeah, well, it's a monoculture when you plant them like that, which a lot of these are. They have been planted as Douglas fir, but it also is a tree that comes in generally after disturbance. So you can get a natural native forest that has 90% one species here.
Okay.
In this case, for our Japanese fir, it does not tend to do that. It grows with a lot of friends. In fact, I will name its friends. Abies homeolepsis, Chemisiparis obtusa, and Abies homeolepsis is another Japanese species of fir tree.
Oh.
Chemisiparis obtusa, we call the Hinoki cypress. No spoilers here, by the way.
Yep, moving on.
Cryptomeria japonica, which you know is a cryptomeria.
That's right, sugi.
Sugi. Pinus parvifolia, which is the Japanese pine, as well as the Japanese black pine, Pinus densiflora.
Wow.
Here's a fun one, Pseudosuga japonica.
Hey.
Yes. Cydopodes reticulata, which is the Kaimaki. The Toria nucifera, which is a kind of, we in California, there's another species, it's called Toria californica, and that they call the California nutmeg.
Okay.
So that's another conifer. It's in the yew family, actually.
Oh.
And then Suga sibaldii, which is a species of hemlock.
Interesting.
Then we have Carpinus laxifolia, Castanea cretata, Phagus crenata, Phagus japonica, and Quercus species.
This is like Game of Thrones. I can't keep up with all these characters.
There's so many. Like, wow. It's this really interesting forest. And I kind of bring this up to give a little quick kind of context about the conifers of Japan versus the conifers of Western North America specifically. So Abies, as the whole group of fir, probably evolved right here in North America, probably in California.
Okay.
There are many different species. If you go from Mexico in Central America all the way up to Alaska, there are probably something like 20 or more species of true firs, Abies, that grow in that area. If you then go to the other side, you just go right over what used to be the Bering Land Bridge, Beringia, and you start going down, you find that there are also like 10 or so species of true fir that are growing in that area, in China, in Japan, Korea, that section.
This is 10 additional species?
Yes, yeah. Okay. At least 10. Probably if we go all the way just a little bit over, if you start going to like the Himalayas and through China. I'm not sure the exact ranges of all these, so I can't give you 100%.
Okay.
But right along that coast, what they used to call, what is it, the Pacific Rim?
Mm-hmm.
The conifers on either side are buddies. Like, they're all the same, like, kind of closely related species that crossed over when the Bering land bridge existed.
Yeah. Which is now the Bering Sea.
Exactly, which is now a giant sea. They crossed over, speciated all this area, and then now the sea's up, and now they've just been on their own for a long time.
Okay, we have sort of this horseshoe shape of Aedes.
Exactly, right in the northern hemisphere, where the Pacific Ring is what they call it, the Ring of Fire is what they've termed a lot. It's basically, you have this giant Pacific Ocean plate, and you have these other plates on either side in Asia and North America, and they would create all these volcanoes. They also, just because of the ocean, have this really, like, nice, moderate temperature, so they're cool. They're moist, and they're also on what tend to be tall mountainous areas.
So if I went to Japan, and I do want to talk about the Japanese fir, but I am curious, if I went to Japan and went into one of these forests, would I feel at home as a Pacific Northwesterner?
Yes, I think you would. Yeah. Okay. Because it's like going from Europe to Eastern North America with the broadleaf trees.
Sure. This is like, you know, you watch the American version of The Office, you know?
Yeah.
There's Pam and Jim and Michael. Then you watch the Japanese version.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
And they all have different names, but they're playing basically the same characters.
Yes.
With some regional, you know, affixes to their character.
It's so brilliant. I think that's a perfect example.
Well, Casey, let's talk about the Japanese fir now.
Yes, let's dial in a little
Aedes
bit.
Aedes firma.
So Aedes firma is a giant tree. It grows like to 150 feet in its native area. Now, I say giant in reference to it being the biggest or one of the bigger trees over there.
Okay.
You'll recall the camphor tree is the biggest broadleaf tree of all the trees in Japan. This, I don't believe, is the biggest conifer, but it definitely rubs shoulders with those tallest conifers in Japan.
I gotcha.
So about 150 feet high, but if you're in, and that's about 45 meters, if you're over in the southeast United States, in fact, where it's often planted as a horticultural species, it only gets about 60 feet tall. So it's not going to reach its maximum capacity outside of Japan.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a shame, but pretty huge tree if you're in there. It's also a classic fir tree where it has that X-current growth form.
Yes.
Meaning that one central leader, and then it has these like branches that come outwards, perfectly flat or upwards to about a 20 degree angle or so.
Okay.
So they kind of look very regimented the way firs do. And they'll maintain that triangular shape their entire life until they get very tippy top, where their tip starts to slow down the upwards growth, but the branches continue to grow outwards. So it essentially grows from a perfectly like formed triangle to the triangle getting wider and wider and wider until it becomes almost a rounded top.
Wow.
Tree. So this canopy, though, is interesting because it's made up of leaves that, Alex, I am so happy to share, have a characteristic I've never come across before.
Wow.
So they are evergreen needle-like leaves that come out left and right from the sides of the twig. Now, they come out left and right from the sides of the twig in what we call two rank. And that's a term that I think we've used a few times, which essentially means that as the leaves come out, they essentially go in one plane to the left and to the right.
Okay.
So they have one rank on the right side of the twig and one rank of needles on the left side of the twig.
As opposed to going like left, right, up and down.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Or like a bottle brush kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's what I was trying to think of. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
So that would be just, there's, you know, that we just call it bottle brush kind of fashion. It doesn't necessarily have a very distinct pattern.
Okay.
But this does, and the pattern is called pectinate.
Pectinate.
Yes. It means like the tines of a comb.
Wow.
And I'm sure that pectin comes from something else.
Yeah.
But that's how they describe it. They say it means that the needles come out very regimented in a form that looks as if they are the sides of a comb.
Okay.
So they don't cross over. They don't go up and down. They're just in one perfect row coming out left, right, left, right, left, right, a whole way down.
Interesting.
So that is the first thing that I love, pectinate, which
that's
means comb-like.
I love a new term.
Yeah. The second one is each one of these individual leaves is bifid, B-I-F-I-D.
Wow, we're full of new ones
today.
We're
just so full of it.
Bifid.
Yes. Do you have any idea what that means?
Two something.
Yeah. Hey, well, great. That was a great start. It means that they have 2 points. They have 2 tips at the end. If you Google the Japanese fir, Abies firma leaf, and you look closely at the very tip, there is, on either side of the midrib of the leaf itself, there is a tiny little point. Do you see that? It looks like 2 little sharp mountains right at the very tip of the leaf.
Whoa.
Yeah. Is that cool?
It's like a tiny little serration just on the tip.
Just on the tip. I had no idea.
That is very odd.
It's amazing. Apparently, they're sharp as hell, which means, of course, if you're trying to think, oh, spruces are spiky.
Right.
Now, in this case, this fir is going to get you.
This fir is not friendly.
No, it's not a friendly fir. This is an unfriendly fir.
Wow.
Yeah. And on fir trees, the cones are always at the top. These are true firs, which means they have upright standing cones.
And they're dehiscent.
Exactly. Ugh, Alex, you are just breaking my heart with how much you're doing over there.
Let me tell everybody what this means.
Please do.
When these cones have served their purpose and their seeds have dropped, they fall apart piece by piece.
Yes, and sometimes the seeds actually stay on and the cones themselves kind of help to distribute them.
Oh, interesting.
Not always.
Oh, though. On the scales.
Yes,
oh,
exactly.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah. And I will say the scales of a dehiscent cone, maybe I'm thinking of cedars, true cedars, which are also dehiscent.
Yes, these are the two greatest examples we can use right
now. Yes, but I know that maybe it's the true cedar cones. Look, the scales themselves look like shark teeth when they fall off.
Yeah, totally.
Is this the similar thing?
It's a similar thing in 100%. Yeah,
all right.
That's perfect. So they are. They're dehiscent. They are upright, which means they look way different than everything but the true cedars. So if you're ever trying to tell the difference apart, in case, true cedars always have their needles coming out on little spur shoots in like these bunches. You're not going to find them singly borne where it's just one needle next to one needle next to one needle.
Yeah.
So keep that in mind.
Okay.
Now, you're going to climb up. You're going to find these cones. They're only about maybe up to 6 inches or 15 centimeters tall, 3 centimeters or about 1 inch wide, a little more than 1 inch. So they're not like barrel shape, but they're just kind of these tall, cylinder-like little things. And, of course, they are always at the top of the tree because that's just how these gosh dang firs grow.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Is that the case, that this is just how they grow? Is there some sort of evolutionary advantage here?
There is an evolutionary advantage, and it is trying to make sure that the cones that produce the pollen, the pollen cones, who would have thought, they are lower down in the tree, and the seed cones are up at the top of the tree. So the pollen cones will release their pollen, and then as it hits wind and currents and goes up, ideally it goes up and away from the tree, and it doesn't necessarily get into the seeds, the seed cones at the top.
So it's kind of separating the parts so that it doesn't self-reproduce or
exactly,
whatever.
Self-fertilize.
Self-fertilize, okay.
You're exactly right.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's why they do it. And a lot of trees will do this. You'll see this in several different conifers, but not all. Not all.
Okay.
So the next thing, of course, you're going to look at is the bark. And Alex, the bark is just fir bark. It's just fir bark. It's gray. It's flat. It's got little resin blisters that you can poke and they spark.
Oh, yeah. I remember that as a kid.
Yeah, everyone does.
Being really into that.
Yeah. Did you know I had a treehouse when I was a kid?
Hmm.
I used to poke those and light, it was in a Douglas fir, and they also have that.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd poke it, and we'd take a lighter, a match, and we'd light it on fire.
That's safe.
And then, yeah, the whole tree, not the whole tree, just that little section would just be burning because it's very flammable. And they were like, yeah, sweet. And then we just put it out.
Oh, man. Your mom would be so pissed.
She'd be so mad. Anyway, sorry, Mom.
Yeah, it satisfies, Dr. Pimple Popper in all of us.
Yes, it really does.
To burst
those
things.
Gross. Dr. Pimple Popper. That is something I never want to think about again.
Just don't Google it.
Okay, I sure won't.
okay, utility. I would call this utility plus because at least it has those little pus blisters, you know?
No, they are resin blisters.
Sure. Yeah,
so,
okay.
Please, this is a family-friendly podcast.
It's kind of interesting.
All right.
But it also is just sort of like, I don't know, gray bark already. I'm like, nah.
It can grow from very low elevations to very high elevations in dry or wet habitats. And it doesn't tend to grow in its own forest. It's always peppered in with all these other species that we named.
Okay.
So it's just kind of one of these species that is a generalist. It can kind of grow just about anywhere. And it's native only to Japan. There is many planted outside of it, but it's only right there. Only, and I had never read endemic, but I'm pretty sure I can just say it's endemic.
Okay. It might as well be.
Yeah.
I get the sense from this Japanese fur that it's like, you know, that like that character actor that you just like see in a bunch of stuff. You don't really know their name.
Yeah.
And just like, oh, that's the guy from that other thing.
You see him in commercials. You see him in movies.
Yeah. And he's always like a minor character in one scene.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and you're like, oh, I love that guy. There he is again.
Yeah.
And then you look at his IMDb page and it's like he has like 150 credits from a bunch of different stuff.
Yeah.
But he's like not well known, but you know his face.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of how I'm feeling about that. He's like a generalist actor,
That's a great example.
I kind of like that. Well, lovely. Well, there's our Japanese fur, Casey.
There it is.
Now, it being Triazaki and all,
mm-hmm.
and us talking Nausicaa and all,
mm-hmm.
how does this land?
Well, Alex, it just so happens that the movie Nausicaa of the Valley of the Wind.
Yes.
It has a lot to do with disaster.
It sure does, Casey.
And this tree, the Momi, is central to some research that the Japanese and other scientists are doing after a disaster that happened in Japan also. Mm. So it's, I don't think, quite assumed. There's no real location for where the Valley of the Wind and, you know, this whole setting is.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where it's just generic Earth, I think, at this point.
Okay.
But it is made of Japan or by Japanese people. So I assume we can at least say, maybe it's somewhere in Japan.
I mean, every artist's art is based on that artist's life.
Exactly. Yeah. So when people say that we are a PNW focused podcast, right. though we can look at you and say, no, you're not 100% wrong.
You have an Oregon bias. You're weird. I wonder why.
Sorry. So I assume that. So, of course, the thing that mostly comes to mind when anyone thinks of a disaster of recent in Japan,
yes.
the first thing that I think of is the tsunami or the earthquake and tsunami that happened in 2011, the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami, to be specific.
I do want to give a quick primer, though, on Nausicaa, so that people, if they haven't seen the film, have sort of context for an ecological disaster.
Yes, yeah, I think it's the right way to do it.
In this episode. So here's the backstory of Nausicaa, mm-hmm. Casey. It's been we start 1,000 years after the 7 days of fire.
Yeah.
This is why I think maybe atomic bomb
parallel. Yeah.
Because it was an apocalyptic war that destroyed everything. Yes, at the time that the movie starts, it's a feudal system.
Yeah.
But this big war created an ecocide.
Mm-hmm.
And this also created the toxic jungles, Casey, which are sort of at the center of this, of the Nausicaa story.
Yes. I can't wait to talk about that.
Oh, me either. Which are basically these huge, noxious fungal jungles.
Yeah.
Filled with what they call om.
Yeah.
Which are these giant insects. Really groovy.
It's really groovy, man. Yeah, what are they? They are they look like trilobites.
Yes,
which are an ancient animal that does not exist, an ancient arthropod.
Yeah, kind of like a armored insect, flat.
Yeah,
low.
It looks a lot like a pill bug. What is a pill bug?
Totally.
Wood lice kind
of potato
thing.
Bug.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
I love that
sure.
term. It was a potato bug. Yeah, and it's exactly right. And this is it's all about these people like kind of dealing with another potential like apocalyptic thing happening to them.
Yeah.
Which is because they essentially anger the forest, mm-hmm. more or less. And that is it's an interesting thing to take place. And the reason that I wanted to do this tree about that is because the most recent nuclear disaster that happened is the Fukushima nuclear plant meltdown that happened after this earthquake and tsunami.
Oh, as a direct result?
Yes.
I don't remember this.
Oh, my gosh. Let's go over it real fast,
okay.
Alex.
Okay.
So the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami was one of the biggest natural disasters. Natural disasters become kind of somewhat human disasters in recent Japanese history. It was the fourth biggest earthquake ever recorded by humans, and we started doing that in 1900. So there's plenty of human history where we weren't recording the size of earthquakes, but suffice it to say, this one was a doozy.
I see that it killed over 20,000 people.
That's right, Alex. It was one of the biggest disasters in Japanese history.
Yeah.
And essentially what happened is you had this 9.1 megathrust earthquake that happened. And what that basically means is that you have the continental plate, which means it's sliding above the plate that is going underneath, which is the Pacific plate.
Mm.
Now, I believe that's how it is. It could be one over the top, but generally the oceanic plates are heavier, so they sink below the other plates.
Okay.
And what happens is it basically builds up a pressure on one plate where it starts to bend, and then that plate basically springs back flatwards.
Oh my God.
So when it springs back, then it essentially is the force of the entire planet pushing up the water that is above it, creating this giant, giant wave.
That's fucking terrifying.
It is crazy. And what happens is basically this giant like wave, and I mean wave as in like a ripple moving through the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Like you can barely see it, and you can find videos of ships just going over this giant swell, and they're perfectly fine. Because in deep ocean, tsunamis are literally no big deal. They're just a gigantic wave.
Hmm.
So, and it's not like there's all these like rogue wave things that we've just been hearing about recently where people are measuring these giant waves. They totally happen. This is different in that it's caused by a specific thing, a specific moment in time and place where you can measure it. And then it goes out in every direction like a ripple through a pond.
Wow.
But the thing is, how waves work is imagine that that is actually a giant column of water.
Yeah.
That giant column of water is, you know, as thick as the ocean. It's a couple hundred feet. It gets moved up and then has to basically get displaced because water must be flat, right?
This makes me sick.
It's insane, Alex. And
it really, I don't want to interrupt you, but I'm going to. Sorry. I say as
listen,
I interrupt you.
I don't want to do this.
It's being a human, a 6 foot by 2 foot human. 2.5 feet, maybe.
Okay. I mean, with your arms out a little bit. Yeah, that's what you're saying.
Is fucking terrifying when you consider the size of the Earth and the size of the elements on the Earth and how much power is in the Earth.
Yeah.
And to think about a 200-foot column of water.
Yeah.
Which is like, you can't fight that.
No. Now, I should say it's 130 feet.
Oh, well.
Is what they believe the highest of the wave was.
Still.
But you're like 100% right. And if anyone wants to really just kind of be stunned, there are videos that you can watch the water. It doesn't show anyone or any, it shows lots of destruction. It doesn't show on YouTube, certainly, anything that you're watching someone get crushed or something like that.
Yeah.
But you can just watch the water come in and go up, because this is in 2011 in Japan, where their technology for cameras and phones was already quite established.
Yeah.
So this is a situation where you had a 130-foot column of water. As it gets closer to the land starts to kind of rise up. The seafloor goes up towards the land, and that forces the water column to move up as well, that entire wave. So what in the ocean is a 40-foot swell becomes a 100-and-some-foot wave where it actually goes up. The reason that waves crash the way they do is essentially the top is moving faster than the bottom because of friction. So that's when you actually get the white caps, when you go from a swell to a wave that crashes and actually breaks, that you see the surfers on and that kind of thing. That's the dynamics of the wave actually pushing on. The bottom is just a little bit slower because of friction, then it crumbles over, and then it just crashes through whatever's in front of it.
Yeah.
Most of the time, it's rocks in the ocean. But this tsunami went upwards of 6 miles in some places and moved one at a speed of 430 miles an hour.
What the fuck?
Is that not insane?
I can't even imagine that.
Yeah, it's literally unimaginable. Like it's one of these kinds of natural disasters that is just the proportions like you're talking about are just so astronomical you can't even wrap your mind around it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very difficult to watch, but it's one of those things where you're just like, oh my God, the power of the ocean. It's unstoppable.
Yeah.
Like when you know, hey, there's this debate like which is more powerful, like fire or water.
It's water.
I think I'm like on the water side.
It's water.
I really truly do. So all this to
plus
say,
there's so much of it, you know.
Yeah, right. Like if the water just keeps on taking it, like it'll just keep on throwing water at the fire, you know.
Wow.
Yeah. So you are right. About 20,000 people were killed, and just to put this into perspective, because it should also be noted, there was another tsunami in 2004, the Boxing Day tsunami. Do you
that
remember
that one?
This?
I remember. Yeah.
This was the day after Christmas, and this was in Indonesia. It happened in the Indian Ocean.
In Sri Lanka, I think, right?
Yeah, Sri Lanka was hit very hard. Okay. So there was a lot of places in the entire like kind of low-lying area around the Indian Ocean. Mm-hmm. Africa wasn't hit too hard, but Thailand and a lot of those kind of smaller tropical islands in Indonesia were that killed 227,000 people. And that was a magnitude 9.3 earthquake. That was just a little bit bigger than the earthquake that struck in just east of Japan.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, the only reason that it probably wasn't as bad in Japan is that Japan is a mountainous area, whereas the low-lying islands in the Indian were way lower. So the water just, there's nothing to stop it. Literally wiped out entire islands. It's the magnitude of these things is outstanding.
200 and how many?
27,000.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's one of the biggest tragedies in like loss of human life aside from war that I think we've ever really measured or seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's wild.
Wow.
So, all that to say, another casualty of this giant tsunami is the Fukushima nuclear power plant.
Okay.
Now, this was in the northern section of Japan, and the big thing about nuclear power is that it needs to be cooled. It will just like essentially burn itself up. So the cooling stations, which is just this water that helps run over certain parts to keep them cool, that has to continue all the time. If it stops for any reason, then the power plant essentially overheats and then melts down. That's the term meltdown. It overheats and just the whole thing goes to shit.
Does this manifest in like explosions or just super fucking hot fire? And
I believe it is an explosive kind of thing where it kind of melts down and then it kind of throws out fallout outside of it.
God.
But you can't always see it. It's not like an explosion where you can see stuff coming out and landing, and then you can look and say, oh, right there is the nuclear stuff. I'm not really sure 100% on the specifics. I don't believe there was an explosion in this case, but there's just particles and like these things that just start to be emitted from this space.
Yeah.
This is all nuclear fallout.
Wow.
So similar thing happens, of course, like you're saying, with nuclear bombs and atomic bombs, where they get dropped and then you get this giant explosion of nuclear fallout that goes over a certain radius depending on the wind.
Mm.
In the case of Fukushima, luckily, the wind was mostly going to the east, so it actually took a lot of the fallout into, for better or worse, the Pacific Ocean.
Okay.
Fewer people, fewer animals, and things like that.
Yeah.
So you end up getting a little bit of fallout that went to the west, and it ended up hitting a bunch of the surrounding farmland and forests.
Oh.
All this farmland and the people had to be evacuated. I believe some of them are able to go back in a certain radius, but there's still a huge amount of space that's literally just been paved over. Like mountainsides are covered entirely in concrete.
Wow.
Yeah. So the tsunami came through, destroyed the cooling systems, knocked them offline. There's a meltdown of the reactor that then spread all of this nuclear stuff. It's like one of two like top level nuclear disasters or like accidents that happened. The other one being Chernobyl.
Right.
Like those are the two top level, this is bad, we need to make sure this happened. There's been lots of other little tiny things that have happened. Who knew that there's like nuclear problems all over the world?
Yeah.
By the way, But those are the two big ones. Most people, of course, know about Chernobyl in, what, 1984 is when it was. Giant explosion and 18 and a half mile wide, gigantic exclusion radius area. No one's allowed in. No one's still out.
It's like Willy Wonka's factory.
Yeah, it is. That's exactly it. Yeah.
Terrifying. Okay.
Anyway.
Is this our most distressing episode ever?
Yeah, it might be. It might be.
I feel awful.
Yeah. Well, I first two things, two caveats. We are not here to give our opinion on if we think nuclear is good or bad. We're not going to discuss that. But a lot of people have opinions on that.
Sure, yeah.
Very strongly.
I'm not ready for that.
No, we're not ready for that. We're just talking about what it is now. We're just, and here we are. The other thing is, I don't know what the difference is between people saying you're pronouncing nuclear wrong. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah. Thing? One is nuclear.
Okay.
And one is nuclear. It's where the L is, either after
nuclear. Nuclear.
Because it's nuclear.
Nuclear.
Yeah. Okay. But a lot of people say nuclear.
Nuclear.
Like George W. Bush said that and got roasted for that.
God, see, that's what I was worried about. I'm like, am I saying this right? What's happening?
Nuclear.
Okay, thank God. Well, yeah. If I say it differently, I don't care.
Wow.
So, I had to come to terms with this because I didn't know the difference for years. Yet people would say it to me and I'd like, I don't know what you're saying.
You know what?
Am I saying it right?
Tomato.
Am I dumb?
Tomato.
Okay, yeah. Now
that's kind of
sense.
What it is.
Thank you, Alex.
Okay, so
for always putting things in perspective for me.
So some of this fallout didn't go into the ocean. It went west.
Correct.
Into forests.
Exactly.
Were there forest fires after this?
No, there was no forest fires.
Okay.
It was a little bit different than the Chernobyl. And we actually got a question about this from one of our listeners a while back. And the question was, is the red forest of pine trees, are actually Scots pine, Pinus sylvestris, a European species of pine. They were essentially killed entirely. They got so much radiation. And I should note, this is from cesium-137 is the element that is decaying. It's a product of the fission of plutonium and uranium.
Okay, I thought that was the username of the listener who asked this.
Oh, hey, what's up, cesium-137? Anyway.
Okay, so that's the element that caused all the
yes
fuckery.
yeah
okay.
Exactly. So that's just a radioactive element. It's actually used often in all sorts of things. Radio chemotherapy is an example of this. Radiation therapy. So it's actually in Seattle there was a nuclear event where some of this powder spilled out, which was cesium-137.
Oh shit.
And so these people like had to literally be decontaminated.
Oh my god.
It was just in Seattle, Harborview Medical Center. Anyway,
it's scary.
Yeah, that was in 2019 maybe.
Oh, not that long ago either.
Yeah. Huh. Anyway.
Cool.
Everyone's smiling. Everyone keeps smiling. Everything's fine. Nausicaa. We're talking about Nausicaa. How did they survive?
Yeah, this sounds very post-apocalyptic,
shit. Yeah. So cesium-137 is essentially spread all over the forests to the west of the Daiichi nuclear plant, which is the Fukushima nuclear plant.
Okay.
So everyone is like, wow, what's happening? As we were saying, in Chernobyl, the same thing happened, and all of these pine trees died, and they turned red, because whenever you see a pine tree, or really any kind of conifer, when they die, they turn this like reddish-brown color.
Oh, yeah.
Essentially, all their needles.
It almost looks like they've rusted.
Yeah. That's a great, perfect example.
Okay.
So that's just everything dries up and turns brown. It's essentially what
okay.
it is.
Okay. It sounds like maybe it was like a chemical reaction or something.
Yeah, right? No, this is how they happen. In fact, I used to learn stories. I think people probably still do this a little bit today. But native peoples in the Pacific Northwest, they would like go up to the mountains in the snow and they'd find these big dead trees that are just completely brown from head to toe, but they're like crunchy dry, and they would just light them on fire because there's not going to be a forest fire. There's snow everywhere.
Yeah.
They just light up these giant trees, and I think they just did it because they're like, you want to see something cool? Like, I'm 90% positive. There's no like...
Wow. Yeah. Hey, yeah.
Maybe there's like something where they'd be like, yeah, let's pray and then light this thing on fire. It's a celebration. Or it might just be like, bro,
this is going to be fucking crazy.
This is going to be sick. That's what happens with these trees. They just turn red, they die.
That didn't happen in Fukushima?
Exactly, because if you are getting doused with these radioactive isotopes, these nucleides, nucleotides, I think something like that. Mm. They are essentially more destructive in higher proportions, or essentially your higher dose. You know, as they say, the dose makes the poison.
Yeah.
So if those pine trees near Chernobyl were right there next to it, so they got a high dose. There's also a huge explosion, so it's a way bigger area.
Sure.
And so all the trees that are right next to it, poof, they died because they essentially got irradiated to death.
Oh my God.
Now here, they did not. But they ended up basically having the same questions. They said, okay, we have this huge nuclear disaster in a place where people live, where we are working, where we are farming, where trees are, where plants are. What happens? Like, what is happening? What is going to happen? We were also not in a war zone, which separates it a little bit from Japan in 1945, mm-hmm. where we couldn't just have all the scientists come in and say, hello, we are going to take some notes. Like, at the end of the day, like, people did try to study that as much as they could.
Yeah.
But under the circumstances, it wasn't really the top priority. So here, once everything kind of got stabilized in terms of this giant disaster that just struck and befell this nation, now they said, okay, we got to clean this up. And then over the next several decade or several years, it's not even been more than a decade and 2 years. Like, it's been 12 years since this happened.
Wow.
Now scientists are coming back and saying, okay, let's start taking some measurements and look into this. And also, of course, there are so many wonderful scientists in this part of the world. They said, hey, we have a horrible thing that just happened. Let's use this and learn from it, because in all over in Southeast Asia, there's a lot of nuclear sites because that's how they make their power. Mm. In a lot of places, Japan has many. So they started measuring these trees called the Japanese fir, the Momi fir, a very common fir that's all over the place. So you can find wonderful amounts of examples across the entire the nation. You can also find it in gradients of distance away from the power plant. And depending on how far away, they could measure differences in how big the dosage of radiation was that they have received from cesium-137.
And I'm assuming because it's a very common tree, there's a lot of research on it.
Yes, we know it pretty well,
yeah,
right?
Okay. Yeah.
So they ended up finding, in kind of a way that you're like, it could be extremely, I think I read a Newsweek article that was like, nuclear fallout causes crazy different, like, changes in morphology of tree.
Yeah.
And you're just like, whoa, like, that's clickbait. You click on it and it's really just true firs, as we talked about at the beginning, tend to grow in very regimented ways. They have one shoot that comes up, and then they have whorls of branches that come out. That's what they do. One shoot. Only if that top shoot gets killed do they end up having adjacent buds grow up, and then you have maybe one or two new shoots that we call it bifurcated stems or shoots that come up.
Wow. So I'm assuming this happened.
That's what happened.
Okay.
So if you go out and top a tree right now, it's the same exact thing.
So that kind of article makes it sound like these trees got so irradiated that they like mutated and became something else entirely.
Yes. Yeah.
They just had to start growing a different way.
They just had to start growing a different way.
Okay. Yeah.
So instead of having the entire tree die, it's actually just the growing shoots and tips that die. So two things are really interesting. One, why didn't the rest of the tree die? It's very curious to me because, Alex, the whole tree is right there. Like, the branches that are lower would have probably got radiation just as much.
Yeah.
But it's just that growing tip, the vertical growing tip that was affected.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I can't find any good reason. No
oh,
one
really?
Says,
Shit.
No one says why. They just say, we noticed this.
I've got a theory.
What's your theory?
There's got to be like some sort of tissue in that growing tip.
Yeah.
That is, I don't know, reacts differently to the radiation.
I guess so.
Right?
But it's like that same growing, like that same stuff should be in all the growing tips.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, but I don't know, you know, it's like, it's really curious. Maybe I'm just reading this wrong where they say, yes, the vertical growing tip is bifurcated, which means that it then grows two new tips, which essentially just means it was topped and then the lower buds ended up coming up.
Yeah.
But I can't see why that wouldn't have happened elsewhere. So maybe they're just not saying it, but it actually did happen.
Sure.
But also, the other thing that's very curious is that it actually peaked 2 years later. They noticed that the growth, because of course it does this, it goes up and then out, then up, then out. So actually I should say it goes out and up every single year, more correctly. So you have the buds that start at point zero.
Mm-hmm.
Then first year, they go outwards and go upwards. Second year, from the tip of what just grew last year, they do that again. So you end up getting these very succinct growth forms where you can look at the whorls on a tree and you can count them, and you essentially can gauge more or less how old the tree is, because each whorl represents 1 year's worth of growth.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in this case, they can look through and say, aha, well, this happened. This is where this thing happened. And then we can count and find that 2 years later, when we're measuring these, we find this tip dieback.
Wow.
So it's very curious about, like, well, why did it take 2 years for the tree to show this, like, this intensely acute thing, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah, which we've always talked about, like, if a tree is growing in year zero, year zero is a really rough, hot year.
Yeah.
Then you will see the effects of that in the following year.
Right.
But that is because the tree basically has fewer resources to allocate for next year's growth.
Yeah.
During the year, it's actually getting, it's allocating those resources. So how did that happen here? If the tree had this one thing that went boop, then it grew normally for a year, then grew normally for another year, and then the tip died.
Interesting. Instead of just 1 year.
Exactly. And then just keep going.
Do firs maybe, like, store extra energy for multiple seasons?
I mean, they could. They'll use as much as they need at any given point.
Yeah.
But they react immediately. So they would react next year for whatever happens this year.
Interesting.
So it's really curious, and this is why I think it's a very important news thing, because we understand, as you noted, it's a common tree. We understand it really well. It's a very common fir tree. But it's also, like, doing things that are just weird enough, you know? Like, if we can just say, yeah, it killed all the tips and then the tree started growing normally again, that wouldn't be a news story. But it is, because the nuclearness of this, like, this specific radiation has caused this tree to grow in a weird way, in a weird way. Isn't that kind of fun?
That is kind of fun. Casey, this whole conversation is tainted.
Yes, that is very true. Yeah, it's got a very nuclear taste to it.
So I want to pitch in a thought experiment here.
Yeah, okay.
This was a terrible disaster.
Yes.
The trees, for all intents and purposes, are somewhat affected.
Yeah.
But not like drastically.
Not like drastically in the way that, A, they weren't killed, so it's less drastic than Chernobyl.
Yeah.
But they're also, we're not really sure, like, how their mutations will continue.
By the way, an interesting sort of thing to think about over the next few decades, like, how these trees evolve.
Yes. Like, that's a huge question.
Yeah. So imagine if, you know, in Nausicaa's world, how massive this apocalypse would have had to have been, the destruction for the ecological change that resulted.
Yeah. It's mind-blowing.
It's pretty interesting.
So that's kind of the big question that we're left with. Like, the scientists are still doing work. They don't have any, like, intense conclusions.
Okay.
Not even sure if there can be an intense conclusion. It's just more of an observational kind of thing.
Yeah, they're just keeping an eye on it.
Yeah. And so in order for all these things to go away, like we were talking about with the half-life, I think of these are somewhere around 30 or so years.
Okay.
So essentially in 30 years, there will be half of whatever total you start with.
Okay.
So it's a proportion, but it's also, this is always constantly going. So in 25 years, then now you still have X amount that's still becoming smaller. It's like a reverse quadratic equation or something like that.
Oh, my God.
Not quadratic, just...
exponential?
Yes, exactly. Okay. Yeah. So it's how fast it decays, and instead of getting exponentially bigger, it's becoming exponentially smaller.
Always reaching towards zero, but never actually reaching zero,
theoretically,
right?
Yeah. Because at one point, it will, you know, it'll decay to the point where now you just have some inert thing that's no longer radioactive.
Yeah.
But how long will that take? Depends on how much you start with.
Do people live around there?
Yeah, some people actually have moved back in. The biggest thing in the news these days is that they are now starting to treat water, or rather release treated water that was radioactive, back into the Pacific Ocean.
Wow.
This has caused a huge uproar because many people are familiar with the fact that Japan is a very fish-oriented culture in terms of its agronomy. Uh-huh. Is that right? No, gastronomy. Uh-huh. They eat a lot of fish.
Yes.
And it's very traditional. And they and other peoples who live in this area, people on, say, the west side of the, I'm sorry, on the east side of the Pacific Ocean are like, "Ooh, hey, we eat fish that like is over there all the time. I don't know how comfortable I am eating fish out of the Pacific Ocean that could have been swimming in and around or eating other fish that were swimming in and around treated water from this nuclear place."
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was also the original fallout.
Yeah.
That went into the ocean.
Right.
So I'm sure that affected the fish somehow.
Something, you know.
If it didn't just like straight up kill them.
It's wild. I didn't do any research into that, but people are. They're actively looking into this.
Wow.
And the Japanese are saying it is okay. We've done every test we possibly can.
Yeah.
This water is safe to be put back into the system. Whew. Yet everyone else is like, ah,
you know,
okay.
Given the history of Japan and atomics, I completely understand why people would be skeptical.
Yeah, totally.
Or like traumatized to even too traumatized to even consider drinking that water or eating those fish.
Yeah, it's wild.
Wow.
So all this to say, this tree's kind of found itself at the center of the. It's at least a poster child of the. Learning about how this kind of nuclear fallout in this one particular area is manifesting itself over time.
Wow.
And it just happens to be a tree that's very common in this part of the world and an endemic tree that's not like endangered or threatened in any way. It's very common. It's all over the place.
Yeah.
So it's just a very curious kind of situation where this tree has happened to be the bellwether that we are measuring. Is everything okay? Is it not okay? How okay is it?
It's sort of, this is an interesting part of this tree's history now. It's like put at the center of this, almost like the center of the scandal. Like now it has to just deal with with this being a part of its world. It's kind of wild.
It's now part of a natural experiment or unnatural, depending on how you want to look at it.
A lot of questions raised. Wow. I'm like so curious to see where this leads.
I can tell you where it leads, Alex.
Into our review.
It leads...
I'm so sorry.
Correct. Yeah, we could have done either way.
Go ahead.
I was going to say it leads straight to the Valley of the Wind.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about that. We got to do it after a break. And before we do that, after the break, but before the Nausicaa, we got to give our review of this tree.
I don't even know what that is.
We're at a break. We'll be right back with more Completely Arbitrary's Triazaki.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back to Completely Arbitrary's Triazaki. That was our discussion of the Japanese fir. Casey's laughing because I left about a quarter of a second for our break. I like doing that. It's fun.
It is very fun. I like it a lot. It just makes it. It's just a little behind the scenes sneak here. Yeah,
it's good. A way to keep the momentum of the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. But you're very good at making the transition in a verbal sense. Uh-huh. You know, hi. I'm back. It's just good.
Thank you. It's because this is all an act. Casey, that was our discussion of the Japanese fir and its tragic, interesting history in the last couple decades.
That's right.
It is time for our review of this tree, and here's how it works. We're going to give some final thoughts on the Japanese fir and then give it a rating of 0 to 10. I would still like to do... Well, we've been kind of tailoring what we're giving to these trees based on the movie that we're talking about. Maybe we do 0 to 10 ohm eyeballs.
We can just do ohms, golden ohms of honor.
Yeah, golden ohms of honor. Oh, I mean, literally, so good. The golden tendrils that they have.
It's beautiful, Alex.
Casey, as our resident expert, we'll begin with you.
Well, thank you, Alex. So this tree, I just really, I don't know, but I wish I did. Like, I don't know that it would not grow well here, but I don't think I've ever seen one, even at the Arboretum, but I may have not looked very closely. We have a lot of European species and Himalayan species and Asian species, but I've never even seen it.
I'd wager that it would grow here. Just,
I think so.
Just splendidly.
Yeah. I mean, it might be a little too dry here often. I bet you on the coast, it'd be way happier.
Okay.
But nonetheless, I bet you we could do it.
Yeah.
So I'm very sad that I cannot actually go out and see and poke these double topped needles.
Yeah.
Which it obviously raises its profile like that's an interesting thing in a tree.
Super.
And a very good ID characteristic. You're just walking around, everyone's like, well, it's a fir tree, but I'm not sure which one. And you just look at the ends of the needles and you're like, oh yeah, easy as that. So this, I like that it's a big tree. I like that it grows everywhere.
Yep.
It seems like it's not overplanted, but it also seems like there's other trees that you might plant a little more.
Sure.
I would say like the Kaiomaki would be a good choice.
Mm.
It's there, but it's also like on the threatened kind of side of things. Whereas
okay.
This one's like dime a dozen. It's like the Douglas fir of Japan.
Sure.
Well, that's not exactly correct, so don't look any further into that metaphor.
I get what you're saying, though.
Thank you, Alex. So I don't know. It stands out, but it also seems like one of those trees that's like, I don't know. There's like 10 of them over here, so no one cares.
Sure.
So I think I'm going to go for a straight 7.5.
7.5?
Yeah, 7.5. In fact, I'm going to go 7.55 because of that double tip.
All right.
I love that. I think that's fantastic.
Now we're talking.
Yeah.
7.55 golden ohm tendrils of honor.
Gross.
From Casey Clapp, the Japanese fir.
What do you think, Alex?
So I feel okay about this tree. I am sorry for its loss in the west of, what was it? Kaiomaki?
No, west of Daiichi.
Yeah, Kaiomaki is a tree.
It is a tree, yeah.
What,
yeah.
What am I, what's the word, what's the K word I'm thinking of?
Fukushima?
Yeah.
It has a K in it. Technically an F word.
The F word. Fukushima. So I like this tree well enough. It's got some quirky characteristics. You know, the fir bark is cool. It has little pustules and things.
These are resin blisters.
Right, excuse me.
Alex.
Not pustules.
Yes, you're causing so many people just horrible flashbacks to high school.
Oh, God. I'm not feeling super energized about this tree.
Really?
In particular.
Well, this is like the one tree you should feel like energized about.
Oh, jeez, Casey. I mean,
it's Lydia radioactive, man.
Yeah, I don't know. Gosh, I don't want to undersell it, but I don't want to oversell it for the sake of, you know, I like giving high ratings.
Yeah.
I'm feeling like a 6.0.
Ooh,
I don't know.
Rough. Hey, if it doesn't inspire you, it doesn't inspire you.
It doesn't inspire me. I'm sorry.
All right.
I think it's just fine. As you were describing it, I was like, it's like looking for something.
It's
like,
yeah, it doesn't. It's got a nice dark leaf. The leaves have 2 points.
Come on. The 2 point thing is it gets it to 2 golden tendrils.
Wow. Okay. So it would be 5.8 without it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's rough. This poor tree.
I think it's just fine. I don't know. I think the story around it is much more interesting.
Yeah.
And because it had, you know, it has nothing to do with that story.
That's fair.
I just don't think it, I don't know. It's so-so for me. That was our discussion of the Japanese fir. Gosh, I feel bad.
Don't feel bad, Alex.
I'm about to feel really good because we're going to talk about a very cool thing. And that is our new segment that we're doing for this month, Ghibli Talk. It was called Ghibli Talk this week.
Exactly. A lot of people don't know that because it's all been edited out, so it is pronounced correctly.
That's right. I'll definitely do that. Casey, this week we watch Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind.
That's right.
I am so interested to hear what you have to say. This movie, as I said, is post-apocalyptic.
Yes.
I should say like post apocalyptic.
Yeah, I suppose that's fair.
Like
yeah.
Civilization has returned, but it is post apocalyptic civilization.
Exactly. Now, real quick, spoilers all over the place.
So oh yeah.
Go take yourself. Go take yourself a nice 2 hours. Go watch it. Come back and press play.
Yeah.
Just make sure to listen to the ads after the show. That's all we ask. I don't even think we have any. Do we have
There are no more poster rolls.
Nice.
On this show,
okay.
Casey.
Yeah. So you're free, guys.
Casey, I'm so curious to hear your thoughts.
Okay. So the first thing is, I have noticed, and you and I have talked about this, Japanese animation has a higher percentage of butts than I've ever seen in like a animated anything.
You know, it's like when somebody mentions a car and then you just start seeing Corollas everywhere.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like
yeah. Oh, I mentioned it. I think
you mentioned that there were a lot of like shots of like butts.
Yeah.
And then you just start seeing them all over the place.
Now I just look at everyone's ass all the time.
I watched this with a friend of the pod, Kyle.
Yeah.
And that was one of the first things he said was like, her skirt is really short.
Yes. And she leans over and you can see very clearly an articulated buttocks.
But I think she's definitely wearing leggings.
Oh, yes. No, 100%. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's not like bare skin.
No. But it's the same thing with My Cousin Totoro. I think I made the comment to you. I'm like, there's a lot of shots of like a little girl like bending over to like pick something up. And like yes. You can see like diaper or something underneath.
Like from behind for
yes,
some
yeah,
reason.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which I have no significant I don't know. I'm not like, oh, well, this means that. Like, there's no literal significance to it.
Sure. It's just something you noticed about these films.
I think it's just an animation, just a stylistic choice.
I guess.
I just think that the so far, I've watched three of these movies.
Yeah.
And they all are, like, kind of hyper-realistic, but also not hyper-realistic.
Hmm.
Like, obviously, how they run is a very thing. Like, if you watch Kill Bill, they run the way that they would run, or they're, like, this kind of style of animation does,
yeah.
Where like the legs just like kind of disappear up and down.
Yeah.
When really you're seeing the legs bend backwards, but because they're bending backwards perfectly in line with the camera, you don't see that they're bending. They just look like they get shorter and taller and shorter and taller.
Totally.
And so in Kill Bill, they run like that a lot, where they specifically made the choice, Quentin Tarantino, I should say.
Wow.
When you see them running, they're almost like da 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 da. No one actually runs that way.
Like little pogo sticks.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah. And so it's a stylistic thing. I've noticed it.
Okay.
And the other thing that I think is like this, like they show like, yeah, well, this is kind of like this futuristic thing. If this was a live action kind of movie and they had this like sexy looking princess out there.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, we're going to get some shots of her butt because all them little high schoolers are going to be all about it.
Yeah.
To which I replied, I now know why this was like a movie that surely a bunch of like teenage boys first saw and they're like, oh yeah, I'm into anime. It was so clear, yeah. Like all over the place. I'm like, it was just everything about it. I was just like, yeah, okay, I see that if I had watched this as a small child entering puberty,
yeah.
This would define what I find attractive.
For sure.
Like, I swear to God.
Yeah.
And I laughed about it very much to myself, actually out loud, watching it, thought it was so funny.
Yeah.
The other thing about this is this really struck me in the Captain Planet style of, like, nuclear disaster.
Mm.
Like, the... I guess parable of it. Is it parable? Allegory of
okay.
It was so clear to the point where they were like, they literally said, and I watched the English translation because it's the one that popped up, and it said, it was like so clear and obvious where they would say, oh, you're saying that we killed a planet like this and now we need to respect nature? Oh, like,
yeah.
And then like you had these flashbacks of like the parents saying, don't worry, this is good for you. We have to kill everything.
Mm-hmm.
We can't live together with these things. And I was sitting there like, this is so, so accurate to the way humans are. Like, we just went through a giant disaster, yet we insist that we must engineer our way. This may seem wrong, but trust us, we're doctors and scientists.
Yeah.
We know what's best. Kill everything that's unnatural, or kill everything that is natural, and our created, curated spaces, those are safe.
Totally.
That's what we want. And I was just like, oh man, this is, it was so blatant. And it's just such a 1980s kind of thing. Like the Fern Gully in the early 90s.
Yes.
And this happened 2 years prior to Chernobyl. This movie came out. Oh,
wow, really? Okay. Yeah.
So like
84, I think this film
is. Yeah, Chernobyl happened in 86.
Okay.
So then 2 years later, this huge nuclear thing happens, and I guarantee anyone who had watched this movie was like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh, who's going to be Nausicaa? Looking around. Like, I thought that was just, it was great. And then at the end, when she basically convinces everyone, nothing is dangerous. Like, in fact, you destroying this thing is what's causing the problem.
Totally.
Like, the insects are fighting back because they're just mad about how you guys have destroyed everything.
Yeah.
It's this, quote, toxic forest, this bad nature that is actually creating the ecosystem services that we're using right now in our little village, pumping up the water.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was, it's so good. Like, that was, I was just like clapping my hands. Like, perfect.
Yeah, it really, it's, it has a very satisfying conclusion. Basically, I mean, how do you even get into the plot? Go watch it, I guess. There's this toxic jungle full of these giant insect creatures called ohms.
Uh-huh.
And there's this sort of high level government plan to destroy this jungle.
Well, yeah, but it's through like different feudal lords.
Yeah, like, there's like factions.
Exactly. And some are warlike and say, oh, well, we got to do this because we have to keep it at bay, because if it gets into our area, it's going to kill us all.
Yeah. And then there's this interesting thing about, you know, the Valley of the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that they're safe here is because the wind blows the toxic spores out of their valley.
Yeah, yeah. Essentially, the wind blows it. My understanding is the wind comes from one direction and blows from them to the forest.
Yeah.
So the forest doesn't like come in through the wind, essentially keeps it at bay.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's always pushing it away.
So there's this section on the Wikipedia article, which I read after watching the film.
Good.
Thank you. Where it talks about the inspirations mm-hmm. for this. And I'm just going to list a few of them, and we can maybe like grab onto one or two. Ursula K. Le Guin's Earthsea. Have mm-hmm. you ever read those?
I haven't, no.
Great fantasy books. Isaac Asimov, the father of modern robotics,
mm-hmm.
Science fiction. Lord of the Rings, which is this cute little book by J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah, it's a nice little series. It's pretty easy read.
It's kind of underground. I don't hear a lot of people talk about it.
It's like, yeah, there's nothing really about it in the media.
And then Dune. And this was the thing that I thought of the most was Dune, watching this. Because it's sort of like feudal but sci-fi.
Yeah.
Which I've been thinking a lot about. I think that's like my favorite genre right now.
Really?
It's like feudal sci-fi, like Dune.
Interesting.
But essentially Nausicaa,
yeah,
our main character,
mm-hmm.
is a princess.
Yes.
Of Valley of the Wind.
Correct.
And her whole thing her whole thing is that she can she has this sort of supernatural ability.
Yeah, yes,
to connect with animals, including these ohm insects.
Yeah.
And you know, she has this sort of zero tolerance policy in terms of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Like even when her enemies are in danger, she's saying, "No, no, no, stop the violence."
Yeah, she does kill like a bunch of people, and she's pretty upset with herself that she did. But it's pretty cool. Like she just went berserk.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
And she instead of being like, "There, I did my job," it wrecks her.
Yeah, she didn't like it.
Yeah. She was also protecting her father.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I really liked Nausicaa in this, and it was like, you know, it is a little heavy-handed in terms of what it's trying to say,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's okay here. It to me, it just feels very. A lot of Japanese media I've watched is sort of like that.
Yeah.
Or like the allegory, or like what it's trying to say is like
fairly blatant.
They just like put it in the script.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
It's like tell, don't show.
Yeah.
I thought that worked here. I don't know. Yeah. I was very charmed by this movie. I watched it with Kyle, like I said, and I was like kind of captivated from the first scene.
Mm-hmm.
And then at a certain point, which is, I think, something that a lot of people wanted us to talk about, I posted a, what do you want to hear about of these things? Yeah, did you see that?
I did.
And we got a lot of responses and a lot of them, a lot of people were really excited for us to watch Nausicaa.
Wow.
And thank you because I had a great time.
What's the next movie you want to watch? You want us to watch?
And
I hope it's Kill Bill.
I hope it's Princess Mononoke because that's what we're doing.
Yeah, I guess you're right. We do have to watch that one.
But at a certain point, Nausicaa and is it Asbel, the prince?
Oh yes.
From a neighboring kingdom, they get sucked under the quicksand of the toxic jungle.
Yeah,
and they find themselves in this like crystal forest.
Yes,
it's basically a petrified forest. Mm-hmm. And the air is clean. There's a lot of stuff in this movie about the air being unclean.
Yeah, it's toxic.
Yeah, everybody wears like these interesting like droopy dog masks.
They look just like some weird version of a gas mask.
Totally, yeah. Like a you know droopy dog?
I think so,
that character that has like big long jowls. Yeah, it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
But under the quicksand here, which is underneath the toxic jungle, mm-hmm. everything's clean.
Yes.
And there's this whole thing about she's, you know, Nausicaa is like a botanist.
Yeah, like she has this little cave or like a hidden area where all these plants grow.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, what are you doing down here? We got to destroy him. Like Patrick Stewart's character does that.
That's right. Lord Yupa.
Yeah, Lord Yupa. She's so good.
So good. Such a great cameo.
He's
not
Gandalf.
Cameo. It's character.
Gandalf.
No.
He's Gandalf.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yeah.
That's the character we're talking about.
I thought you were.
Is Gandalf.
I thought you were confusing him for Sir.
Oh yes, I see the actor who played. Yes. No.
Yeah, she's like a botanist, and she's figured out a way to like cleanse these toxic plants, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah. Well, I think she says that it's the soil. They're essentially growing and spewing what they're growing in.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that is the fascinating part where like everything is toxic because everything is toxic.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Not just that the plants are toxic, but that they're like drawing toxicity.
Yeah. It's like the plants are just dealing with what they are dealing with. Mm-hmm. They are not the things. They're not the cause. They are the proximate issue. They are a symptom.
And the Om are the same way. The Om are reactionary. They are reacting to the humans, I guess.
Yeah, well, they're trying to keep the humans at bay and like keep them, at least allegedly. You know, Nausicaa makes a lot of pretty intense conclusions, okay? Which I think we can put on the... Why don't you have a little bit of a questioning mind, Nausicaa?
It is true. There's a lot of jumping to conclusions in this movie.
Yeah, she's not very skeptical. She's just like, oh my God. It turns out, and then makes this sweeping declaration that they're, you know, doing all these things. So it's like, okay.
She'll like see something and be like, they're reacting to the so-and-so. And I'm like, how do you know that?
Yeah, like that is that's okay. Thank you. I assume you're right, but let's just maybe not bet everything on this. Maybe hedge our bets a bit.
But I will say it maybe makes sense because, and it's big spoilers, she is like the chosen one, I guess.
Yes, yeah, it's true. Yeah.
This myth is set up in the beginning about this warrior who will return and cleanse the land. Mm-hmm. And they, what does it say? They wear blue.
Yeah.
And they walk on a field of gold.
Yes.
And at the end, this imagery is replicated. But she's wearing this blue outfit, and she's being lifted up by the golden tendrils of the Om. She's like, you know, she's solved everything. And how does she solve everything, Casey?
She just listens.
She listens.
Yeah.
She solves it with peace, with listening, with understanding, not more warships and giant guns and destruction.
Yeah. And I think that is like the sentiment of this time of like the entire world. Like everyone was like, whoa, like the Clean Air Act hadn't been in place for more than like 10 or 15 years at this point. Like this is all happening at a time when everyone is looking around and literally seeing the world get destroyed. And all like collectively are saying, can we put the brakes on this right now?
Yeah.
And like, and unfortunately, I don't think the brakes were necessarily put on. I think we just shoved it off to a place where we don't necessarily have it right in front of us.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I loved this movie. There's so much to it. I feel like we're not quite doing it justice in this conversation.
Right, there's no way we could. This is not a movie podcast.
Well, no, but in addition to that, there is just so much happening. There's so many different sort of perspectives, and there's a lot of plot. It's a very busy movie.
It very much is. That's true.
But so good. And before we wrap up, Casey, the soundtrack.
Oh my God. The soundtrack is so good.
So, so good. This is by Joe Hisaishi. Hisaishi? Mm-hmm. It's like if John Carpenter made anime. It's so fucking great. I
don't
love
even
it.
Know what that means.
Somebody does. That was our review of Nausicaa. We hope you go watch it. We hope you enjoy it. Casey.
Alex Krosen.
It's time for a completely arbitrary AMA.
Let's do it.
John Collier asks, well, the subject line is for trees that fix nitrogen.
Interesting.
My understanding is that they have bacteria that live in their roots that fix the nitrogen.
Many of them do.
When a tree grows from a seed, is the bacteria a part of the seed or the DNA?
Oh.
Does it get picked up from the soil? Where does it come from? 4 question marks.
Interesting.
Thank you, John.
Very good question.
Now, Casey, I chose this. We had kind of a funny, we had a bit of a comedy of errors at the beginning.
We did. A little who's on first.
We did, yeah.
Who's fixing the planet?
Right. I chose this question because I saw...
Atlas is fixing the planet. Anyway, I'll explain it in a second. Yeah, now Atlas has got it. Flush of great ideas.
I chose this question because I saw, you know, nitrogen fixing.
Yes.
I was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, how do trees, and I kind of like extrapolated what we were talking about today into like, how do trees fix the nuclear fallout
soil,
which isn't really what we were talking about. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, but it also has to do with Nausicaa because the trees are like fixing the soil and the water and cleaning the soil and the water.
Yeah.
And you're like, Alex, you said, you are so stupid.
I did. I believe I actually kind of shouted it. Shout it kind of downwards at you a little bit too.
You are so stupid.
Yeah.
You did not say that, but I realized my mistake, which is that these are 3 completely separate things.
Yes.
So Casey, please, for the stupid among us, or the uninformed among us.
Now, just to be clear, I'm talking about you.
If you're wondering if I'm talking about you, I am. What is nitrogen fixing?
Yes, nitrogen fixation is the process of something fixing atmospheric nitrogen to a terrestrial thing.
Now, this is the definition of fix here.
Yes.
Is like a fix.
Exactly. Like, not repair.
Right. This is like a fixing a photo to your wall.
Yes.
It's like attachment.
Yes. So nitrogen is actually, I think, 80% of our atmosphere.
Nitrogen?
So, oh, yes. Wow. And technically it's dinitrogen because it is a covalent bond. I believe that's the term.
I haven't heard that word in 20 years.
What? Oh my God. We talked all about nuclear fission today.
Yeah.
This is good.
This is science class today.
Yeah. Welcome everyone. Science Friday. So yeah, the covalent bond means essentially it's like oxygen, O2.
Yeah.
It bonds with itself very strongly. So you never have just a single oxygen molecule floating around. You have 2 oxygens right next to each other. And they're connected and chilling.
So when we say nitrogen, we really mean dinitrogen.
Yes, technically.
Okay.
But really, yeah, it'd be like N2 would be how you'd see it. It's just like O2.
Okay.
So what that means is that we have 80% nitrogen. 80% of everything we're breathing in right now is in fact nitrogen.
Okay.
So that is an unusable means of nitrogen, yet nitrogen is one of the most important macronutrients in plants, in really truly everything.
Hmm.
So there are a lot of plants that need nitrogen. There's a lot of animals that need nitrogen. However, that has to be taken from the atmosphere and fixed to something in the soil that then can be absorbed by other plants and then be eaten by other animals.
I see.
Yes. So it's being affixed to some other chemical, and then they are creating essentially what is, you know, just some bonded thing in the soil that now you have nitrogen that's actually in here. So usually it's like nitrite or nitrate, one of the two.
Uh-huh.
So
okay,
that's what they're doing. And so that's what's happening. And inside of the roots of certain legumes, which are anything in the family Fabaceae.
I knew that.
You did. It's the pea family. God, Alex, you're getting good. You're getting good. So all of those actually have a funny little node that is in its roots, or I should say they have nodes in their roots. Mm. And that is what we're talking about here from Mr. Collier. This is a biological symbiosis that these plants have created amongst themselves. And they have these little nodes that a soil bacteria gets in. It's called rhizobia. Rhizobia is just a bacteria that lives in the soil.
Okay.
Essentially, it invades into these roots where they have created this root nodule, almost like a gall kind of thing, where a wasp kind of stings a tissue of a plant, mm-hmm. and then the plant tissue like does something really weird. Similar thing.
I'm almost imagining like functionally like a lenticel, like as some sort of exchange point.
You know, it might be that they get in through something like that,
yeah.
but then the node, the plant doesn't like fight back against it. The plant essentially says, oh, okay, cool. I'm going to create this little space. And then those individual bacteria colonies start to fix nitrogen from the air in the, just kind of dissolves and kind of goes into the soil. So there's not like this perfect barrier of soil and air.
Okay.
Air goes into the soil, and that's kind of an important thing about plants. They have to have good aeration.
Yeah.
Oxygen and nitrogen both are in the soil. So if you are a tree that grows in a space that is not very nutrient rich, like for instance, a dry habitat or habitat that's very wet that has a lot of leaching happening, then you tend to really want to have the ability to fix your own nitrogen, a very important element.
I'm reminded of another thing from nature, Casey.
Tell us.
I'm just so full of rememberings.
From nature?
Reminderings. Yes, yes.
Okay, yeah.
I'm reminded of chlorophyll, which started in ancient times as an algae.
That's right.
That formed such an integral, close relationship with plants.
Uh-huh.
That it just became a part of the plant and now it's built in, right?
Exactly. Yeah. They are biologically created in and of each other. Their DNA is like put together.
Yeah.
Kind of, but not technically.
So I'm reminded of like, you know, the Fabaceae plants that have these little nodules.
Yeah.
It's like, this is like a, where was I going with this? Fuck.
Yeah, I know where you're going with it.
Yeah, complete my thought.
Well, Alex, as you were thinking, this is a little bit different than that, where it's actually a soil bacteria, and this gets to John's question. It is a soil bacteria that lives in the soil. When the plants actually grow and put their roots down, then this relationship happens. They come together.
Yeah.
So
okay.
The difference being for chlorophyll, for mitochondria, that is passed down.
I gotcha.
So it is not something that they will capture from the air and say, oh, hey, there's a chloroplast, and they pull it up, and then they keep it in the leaves. It's actually something that is created in and of the plant, where they have become a functional part of the plant in such a close way that they are the same thing now.
I understand now.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's a little bit different, but conceivably, Alex, it's the same process, you know? Like.
I was also thinking conceivably, Casey, in a million years,
yeah,
maybe Fabaceae plants will just be like born with this bacteria in their roots.
Like, I think it, probably more on the realm of like 20, 30, 40 million years.
Okay.
Because when it first happened, they were essentially single-celled organisms, and those single cells got together. So now you just had something that was kind of like one cell inside of another cell. Again, I should say, this is all theoretical. Of course, no one was there. We can't really tell for sure, but we have a pretty good idea. It was probably just one single cell got together with another single cell, and they basically said, yeah, sure, well, let's work together. And then that's what they did.
Okay.
A lot easier to kind of make quick transitions that way, so to speak, rather than an entire tree that's now so much more, has literally millions, billions of years of cellular life that has got chlorophyll to be what it is now with plants.
Yeah.
I should say chloroplasts. Meanwhile, sorry, Alex, I know you were offended by that. So
you said it with such a... with such visceral. Yes.
Or should I say,
chloroplasts.
I do. I say it like the Emperor in Star Wars. Chloroplasts.
Bring me the chloroplasts.
Oh, that was really good. Gosh, got shivers there.
Sorry.
No, that was it. That was totally it.
We're off the rails today.
Yeah, we are. Yes. So in this case, in lots and lots of millions of years, then could potentially these plants will essentially become partners, and one will somehow have a horizontal transfer of their DNA into the other. And then they will just reproduce. The thing that I think would be very curious is if the plant cells somehow are pulled inside of the fungus, or of the bacteria, rather, and then that bacteria basically grows in the soil and says, you know what I need right now? A little light energy.
Wow.
And then it pops up its little thing,
and it starts
to use its little leaves, and then it goes back down when it doesn't need anymore.
Now, this is very interesting. It could be like its fruiting body or something.
Right? Flip the script. Why does a plant have to take in the bacteria in the fungus? What if the fungus is basically just saying, you know what? I need a forest. I'm getting kind of low on energy, so I'm just going to make this happen.
That's very cool. Yeah, I like this idea.
I wonder if anyone's ever thought about that before.
Well, I will say, and maybe you're setting me up for this, but in Nausicaa, These toxic jungles are fungal.
You'd think so, yeah, because they always say spores. Everything is a spore.
Yes, and if you just look at the design of them too, like they're giant mushrooms.
Yeah,
Which I've always thought is kind of interesting.
It is very curious, but they kept calling them trees, and we can't say that they were 100% not.
Oh yeah,
but we'll have to talk about that some other time, Alex.
Because it's time to end our episode. Thank you, John, for your question. If you got a question for us, and you want to support the podcast and get bonus audio material, bonus video material, monthly cone stickers, ad-free listening.
Pretty much everything that you could ever want.
That's right.
Relating to trees and other related topics.
Join up on Treemium. That's arbitrarypod.supercast.com.
That's right.
It's the best way to support the podcast.
It's a lot of fun.
We're very excited about it. And we hope you join us. You can gift subscriptions, like we said. You can buy an annual subscription. You can just set it and forget it. Put those episodes right into your podcast player so you get ad-free listening anytime you want.
That's it. It's all you got to do. It's very easy to sign up. So go find yourself there.
Yep. Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
I feel like that's when we're both walking in the same place. We say goodbye, but then we just keep walking for another like 10 minutes next to each other.
Oh, you're parked down here? Oh, yeah, me too.
Yeah, anyway. We're walking in silence.
So thank you, John, for your question. Casey.
My first name is John. A lot of people don't know that.
Oh, that's right.
So every time you say thank you, John, I'm like, Alex, you never call me John.
If I get really upset at you someday, I'll call you John.
Thank you, Mother.
Casey, I had a great time with you today, and thank you for watching the film. I really appreciate you, from what you've told me, this kind of media does not come easy to you. So I really appreciate you kind of working outside your comfort zone.
Thank you. Yeah, yeah. I usually am sitting down. I have to strap myself into the chair.
Yeah, put those exactly. Clockwork Orange eye stretchers on.
Yeah, exactly. So I just have my assistant come over with some eyedroppers. And you know what? I can stomach it.
You're just gagging and retching and asking them to please turn it off.
It is not that bad. It is lovely. It's a very enjoyable time.
I thought you would like it because, you know, as more integral to his films than the art style is the messaging, which aligns perfectly with who you are.
It very much does. Specifically this one. I think the messaging in this one is much more concrete to what I'm like, yes.
Totally.
Please, everyone, see that. See what they're saying.
I think that's part of the, part of the bluntness. Maybe he was like, you know what, I just need to like lay it out for people. Because there's a lot of interpretation in Totoro and Spirited Away.
But they're also like spirit things. Like the whole thing is a spirit metaphor.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's been a grand time,
my friend.
It's been
a grand time. Let's do this again.
Hey, you know what? Let's do it again next week.
Okay. See you there.
And the movie we're going to watch, I think people are going to be very excited about this one. We're watching Princess Mononoke, Casey. I would say of all Studio Ghibli films, in my experience, either the one that almost everybody says is their favorite
yeah.
is either Spirited Away or My Princess Mononoke.
Really?
So we've got some big ass shoes to fill, my friend.
All right. Don't tell me. I have no idea what this one's about.
You know what?
No clue.
I don't either.
You haven't seen it?
I have not seen it.
What?
We're going to be fresh going into this.
No way. I thought you watched them all.
No. I have not seen. I've seen the first like 10 minutes and I got distracted with something else.
I cannot believe this.
Yep. It's going to be great, Casey.
Wow, we're going to do it live.
Yep, we're going to do it live. And we'll see you next week. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Completely Arbitrary's Triazaki. We will see you next time. Goodbye.
Au revoir. Completely Arbitrary is produced by Alex Croson and Casey Clapp.
Our artwork is by Jillian Barthold, and our music is by Aves and the Mini Vandals.
And you can support the podcast at patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
And find additional readings at completelyarbitrary.com. Thanks for listening.